I'm Ben Kiefer of Iowa Public Radio News, moderating a discussion at the Iowa Cancer Moonshot Summit in Iowa City on June 29th, 2016. And today we're coming to you from the Medical Education and Research Building on the University of Iowa campus. Joining me after that opening by Vice President Joe Biden about this moonshot, we now have a panel discussion, 10 panelists here, all kinds of people with different perspectives, joining in the cancer community, researchers, oncologists, care providers, philanthropists, patients, and of course cancer survivors. We have a spectrum of them on our panel today, and we'll hear a few words so that we round out this event to get an exploration of all the different facets that are involved in the cancer moonshot. We just heard the Vice President speak and give his vision, his inspiration, his confidence and dedication in the cancer community across the nation and also here in Iowa. I want to turn to our panelists, and because we have 10 of them, it would take me several minutes to introduce each one of you. So I'd like to have each of you just tell us who you are and then your connection to this moonshot, and we'll just go right through the line, and perhaps we can start right at the end. Is it Sarah at the end? No. Laura Rogers. Let's start at the end with Laura.
Yeah, I am a postdoctoral fellow here at the University of Iowa in a cancer research lab, and our lab focuses on understanding the immune system as it relates to cancer and working on therapeutic approaches to harnessing the power of the immune system to effectively treat cancer.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about your research, because immunology is really a new area, and many of our listeners will not understand what is happening when you do
immunology that. In the context of cancer is a new area. Yeah, and you know, I think it's a really exciting time to be studying the immune system as it relates to cancer because of the new immunotherapies that are showing a lot of clinical success. The anti-PD-1. Anti-CTLA-4 therapies that we've been hearing about. The really great thing is that they seem to have a very long-lasting positive impact for those patients for which it works, but that turns out to only be about 30% of patients. And so for those other 70%, right now we're trying to understand how can we better predict who will respond, and how can we help those who are not responding? How are the people who are responding actually responding? And so, you know, my specific research project is devoted to understanding the genetics that happen within T cells. And finding ways to use T cells and to augment their anti-tumor activity.
Sitting next to Laura is Gary Streit, I believe. Gary, tell us about what you do and your role in the moonshot. What's your moonshot, as we've been hearing the question asked?
I think my moonshot would probably be the elimination of barriers to affordable, effective treatment. I'm one of the token lawyers on the panel with Margaret, although I think I'm still recovering and she's found a better career. My involvement with the American Cancer Society spanned over 35 years, and one of the things we really focused on as an organization is legislative changes that really can move systems, whether it's clean air, smoking, prevention through tobacco legislation. But really, when you get to the root of it, the biggest predictor of a person's effective treatment from cancer is access. And we have far too many barriers. And so what we're really advocating for, what I've worked on, whether it's raising money for research or opening my mouth when I shouldn't at the legislature, is really trying to change the paradigm and to make sure that people get access no matter where they live, their race, their color, their gender, their ethnicity, because that's really what probably our biggest shortcoming is.
Sitting next to Gary Streit with the American Cancer Society, a volunteer there, past chair for the National Board of Directors for the American Cancer Society. Next to him, I believe, Dr. Aaron Bossler is with us, director of the Molecular Pathology Laboratory and a member of the Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center, also clinical associate professor in the Department of Pathology. Dr. Bossler, what's your moonshot? What words of the Vice President most spoke to you and your expertise?
Thanks, Ben. So when we were talking earlier about, you know, going to the moon, my role in all of this is kind of as the navigator. I'm the guy that's helping to look at these, reading the patient's DNA to figure out if there are markers there that are going to help us to identify if they're going to respond to therapy. And it's really exciting when we're able to do that. But just like Laura was saying earlier, it's only a certain percentage of patients that we're able to provide that. And so my moonshot is you know, to be able to expand that, build on that data that's being shared to help identify additional markers to be able to help the oncologist in providing the best care we can.
Mm-hmm. What is, just to follow up there, what is the barriers behind not sharing data? How do we get to share data yet? Why hasn't data been shared enough up to this point?
That's a great question. I mean, I think Vice President Biden touched on this when he referred to all the money that was spent on generating these electronic medical records and how they can't speak to each other. Well, the same thing is happening on multiple levels of cancer research and at clinical cancer diagnostics with trying to share this information and read it in a way electronically so that you can efficiently and effectively tease out what's important. So I think a huge investment there is going to help us to be able to use that information more efficiently and you know, be able to find additional things that we can use to treat patients.
Thank you, Dr. Bosler. Sitting next to Dr. Bosler, Christopher Squire is an American Cancer Society volunteer, also professor of dentistry and a cancer researcher in tobacco causes of oral cancers. We had him on our airwaves a number of times over the years to talk about what Chris Squire is still the number one cause of cancer in the United States and around the world, right?
Indeed, yes.
Yeah. What spoke to you most about the Vice President's words, and what is your moonshot?
Well, I was pleased to hear him talk about tobacco and the fact he mentioned a trial that was underway. But I think the important term he used was collaboration and teamwork, because increasingly I see the value in being able to take the knowledge that we have from the lab, from the clinic, into policy, because the way we're going to address tobacco use, and there's no doubt about it, this is a major cause of death and disease, and when we look at cancer, 30% of all cancers are associated with tobacco use, and in my particular area, cancer of the mouth, probably 90% of those are associated with tobacco use. It's something that we know how to address. It's low-hanging fruit. If we could reduce tobacco use, we would certainly reduce the burden of cancer. But we need this collaboration, and so that pairs my research faculty position with my other role, which is a volunteer with the American Cancer Society, which I believe has been a strong force in working with policy, with advocacy, to convince our politicians that they have got to take action here. And it's good to see some of our supporter politicians in the audience here. They know well what I'm talking about. The only thing is, we are faltering right now in Iowa. Tobacco use has not going down at the rate it had been going down, and we need renewed effort, and a lot of that is going to rest with policy. So that is my moonshot, coupling the science with policy, which will bring about outcomes, positive outcomes.
Mm-hmm. What do we know about how we affect those positive outcomes? If my memory is correct, something like 40 million Americans still smoke, still use tobacco. We have known for decades that it is connected with cancer. So, and many of these are young people. What is not getting through? What are we not doing to connect and change minds and stop the use of tobacco?
Well, at the simplest level, there's a mantra: make it more expensive, make it harder to use, that's better tobacco control legislation, make it easier to give up, to quit. Very simple things to do. Some of those are built on improved science. Behaviors here are a big part of it, but as I've already said, a lot of this is built on policy and painful and unpopular things like putting up the price. single most effective way of reducing tobacco use.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is the tobacco industry still lobbying against these efforts? Are they the biggest barrier?
Well, that's a sort of a separate presentation. Yes. and they have new approaches that are even more devastating, using litigation to contest health measures, combating every approach that's taken, challenging it as a matter of course, regardless of how effective it's going to be. And we've seen this in Australia with the plain packaging. We're seeing it here with attempts to put warning labels, bigger warning labels on packets. It delays it even if it doesn't stop it.
Chris Squire, there of American Cancer Society volunteer, also a longtime professor of dentistry at the University of Iowa, does a lot of research into tobacco and the causes of oral cancers. I'm Ben Kiefer of Iowa Public Radio News, with the pleasure of moderating a discussion at the Iowa Cancer Moonshot Summit in Iowa City on June 29th, on-site at the Medical Education and Research Building on the University of Iowa campus. Vice President Joe Biden, we heard a bit of him earlier, and says we need a cancer moonshot, using that image to accelerate the progress that we need to make in conquering cancer to end cancer as we know it. And the University of Iowa Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center is part of that, along with other cancer centers across the country. Let's turn to another one of our panelists. Margaret McCaffrey is with us, a cancer research supporter and a philanthropist, a very important part of the cancer community here. Margaret McCaffrey, let me ask you if I can have you talk a little bit about your personal connection with the philanthropy in cancer research. Your son, Patrick, is a cancer survivor. How is he doing?
We
did slide, perhaps slide the microphone a little bit over to Margaret, or yeah, there we go. So we have a nice close.
Good.
Okay, very good. Yeah, tell us about Patrick and how he's doing today. A little bit about his cancer background.
Well, Patrick is 16 today. He was diagnosed with thyroid cancer when he was 14. We were very fortunate that the tumor was found. It was sort of a fluky process, and some of you may know a little bit more about our story because it became quite public because of my husband's job. Patrick's first surgery to remove the tumor was the same day that the University of Iowa men's basketball team was playing in the NCAA tournament for the first time in a number of years. So we went through quite a lot of, it was quite an ordeal, and it became a very public thing, but I think there were different ways to react to that. Some people would want to hide and try to keep that as private as possible. We chose to make it a public thing and be more than willing to discuss it so that we can help raise awareness and call attention to issues that need to be focused on. Mm-hmm. And that is what Fran and I have continued to try to do. We were actually active with the American Cancer Society and other fundraising and organizations in the past. And then, as Fran likes to say, you never know when you'll become the beneficiary of your own philanthropy. And unfortunately, we became that. And we are now working really hard to help the people at the University of Iowa and the Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center and the Children's Hospital develop an adolescent and young adult cancer program, because this is an age group, it's about 13 to 30, that is underserved in a lot of areas, psychologically, socially, emotionally, and then as well as the research behind how the disease affects people in this age range and how they should be treated. Do they treat them as pediatric patients? Do you treat them as adult patients? So that's kind of what we're doing, and it's a long explanation, I guess.
I'm interested, Margaret. Once you have cancer touch your family in the way that it's touched your and Fran's your family this way. You have a different perspective, and many of us are lucky enough not to have that perspective. You have the insider's perspective. What changes when you look at a diagnosis of your son in this case and your family, and how you see this challenge of research and treatment of cancer? How do you think about it differently now than you did prior to the diagnosis of your son?
I mean, everything changes. You know, your life as you knew it is over. We would refer to it as the new normal, which would be every day after you hear the words that, you know, you have cancer or your child has cancer. I can tell you what it's like to wake up a 14-year-old boy and tell him that he has cancer and look at him and know that he thinks the first thing that came into his mind was that he was going to die. And I can tell you what it's like to be with another family who had a boy the same age who did die, and watch the two boys fight together and bond together. And, you know, your life is never the same. And I think that one of the other things that Fran and I are trying to get across, and he does it more because people want to hear from him more, I guess. I don't know why, but anyway, is you're never, you know, people want to hurry to say that, oh, I'm cancer free. I'm, you know, or you are, or this is you're now, you're never free of cancer ever. Once you hear that, at least in my opinion, it is something that lives with you for the rest of your life. And every time Patrick goes to the doctor, he's terrified. I had to chase him through the backyard in the fall to get him to go to an appointment, and I can't catch him. He's about 6'6", and he's way faster than I am, and my knees are shot. And he, you know, he's afraid every time he goes because you never know what you're going to hear. And it's like that for the rest of your life. And fortunately, he will be monitored for the rest of his life, so that we hope that if there is anything that develops, it will be caught. And so that is a benefit of that, but it's also something that you live with.
Sitting next to Margaret is Dr. Mohammed Milam, Deputy Director for Clinical Cancer Services at the Cancer Center. And he's reminding me again, as we met before this, he likes to go by Dr. Mo. So
no, just Mo, no titles.
Just Mo, okay.
Titles make it complicated, just like cancer is. I mean, I heard in Biden's speech something that I want to change my mind about things. I actually felt empowered to make changes that to a culture that's developed over time and kind of deep-seated its roots like a fungus and doesn't want to change, grows very slowly. I heard him say, break the chains and start doing stuff today, urgently. And I think I can speak to that a little bit more. I felt the passion come back into my heart to change the words that he used, despair to hope. I think you heard despair. I have walked many of my patients from that point of death. And I want to remind everyone, I'm the one in front of the patient. I have to give them hope. I have to change that despair and change it to hope. And with the armamentarium that we have right now, I want to do that. I really want to do that. And I want everyone in this room, whoever and whatever you can do that. That's what I heard him say. He said, everybody, get up, get off your asses, and start doing something.
Mo, if I may use that. Tell us about one of your patients who is also on the panel. For the moment, I'm going to skip over Mary Charlton and go to Rob Alberts. He is one of your patients. We want to hear from him in just a moment. Tell us about his case.
Okay. First of all, he's not my patient. He's my hero. Second, he believed in me. Third, he went on an experimental therapy that's never been tried in the tumor that he had on his back. By trusting the people that put him on that trial, he's now surviving his cancer. It's a new therapy that might have a new indication that I would like to accelerate and put more people on that trial. But as Biden had said, only 4% of patients go on clinical trials. So you have to imagine that this is one of the 4% of people who actually trusted their doc and went on a clinical trial. So it's my honor to present one of my favorite heroes, Robert Albert.
So So, Rob, we're please slide the microphone a little bit closer to you. We really want to hear from your perspective as a cancer survivor and someone who has gone through trials and is here with us today. What's your moonshot? How does this connect with you as a cancer survivor?
Well, first of all, I want to thank him so much because this was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do in my life. When I first found out that I had cancer, and it's sarcoma, and you know, I didn't even know what sarcoma was or anything like that, but the University of Iowa, I'm so tickled to death with. I can't imagine being anywhere else. Like I was telling her earlier, it's very emotional. Like I was telling her earlier, you know, I was, what, I'm 49. I was 40, well, it was just last year, so I was 48 when I was diagnosed. So I went all this time with, you know, without thinking about cancer. Last 3 or 4 years of my life really focused on nutrition and exercise, thinking I'm not going to get this, you know, eating right, not eating processed foods, anything. Boom, it appears. Scared to death. Came up to Iowa here, or the hospital here, and spoke with Dr. Miller. And then that's when Mo and the team came in effect. And I was right before I came up here, believe it or not, my wife and I, we prayed and I said, you know, if this is cancer, this was before the biopsy. I said, if this is cancer, I want to be part of the cure. And sure enough, Dr. Miller introduced me to Dr. Mo, and I'm number three. Number three in as far as the sarcoma research, and I'm happy with the results. I had my surgery in December, so I'm only 6 months into the recovery process, but Dr. Mo, Dr. Miller, I don't know what I'd do without them. Mm-hmm. I really don't.
You want to be part of the cure. Do you see yourself? It's bigger than just your case than what you're saying.
Oh, for sure. I know I'm not the only sarcoma patient or survivor or anything like that, but you know, when you go through all your life like that, being healthy and ex-smoker and, you know, trying to do all this stuff to make your life right, and all of a sudden this comes up, you're thinking, why me? Why? I'm doing everything right. What the crap? You know? And so of course...
What answer did you arrive at?
You know, you don't really have an answer. It's now you have to focus on surviving, because when you hear the word cancer, like she said, you automatically think of death. I didn't want to die, but I'll tell you what, my life flashed before my eyes. You don't want to hear the word tumor. You don't want to hear the word cancer. But I'll tell you what, between Dr. Mo and Dr. Miller and the research and all that stuff, I felt that, you know what, this is not my death sentence. I have to follow what they said, which I didn't a couple of times, and I regret. but those were learning curves, and I would bring everything back to him and let him know, okay, this is what you got to do, because this is how I felt. So I feel privileged to be part of this research, and I pray like crazy that this does not come back.
Thank you for sharing your story, Rob. Wonderful that you could be with us today. Rob Alberts is a cancer survivor and also a clinical trial participant at the University of Iowa Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center. We have panelists here talking about the Iowa Cancer Moonshot. Joe Biden, our vice president, speaking earlier in the program, and now we're hearing from panelists assembled here at the University of Iowa campus. And let's make sure we hear thoughts, because we have so many interesting perspectives on this cancer moonshot. Mary Charlton is in the Department of Epidemiology in the University of Iowa Public College of Public Health, and a co-investigator with the statewide Iowa Cancer Registry. Mary, tell us about your moonshot.
Well, I would have to say that the one thing that the Vice President said that struck me the most is sometimes it's not that we don't know what to do, but we are not urgently trying to do it. From the public health standpoint, we've already talked a lot about tobacco. Between lung cancer and colorectal cancer, that's 35% of our cancers here in Iowa, cancer deaths here in Iowa. We know how to prevent lung cancer. We haven't talked about radon yet, which is the second leading cause of lung cancer and a particular problem here in Iowa, where 7 out of 10 homes have an elevated radon level. Yet some of our policies don't support testing and mitigation in schools, in homes, and things like that. Also, with colorectal cancer, we know that screening could reduce 60% of colorectal cancer deaths, yet our screening rate here is only close to 60%. So that's the other thing. The other quote he said when he was talking about the pharmaceutical companies and the cost of drugs, you know, what is the possible justification for the cost? For me, that question is, you know, what is the possible justification that someone goes under anesthesia thinking they're having a screening test and won't pay any money out of pocket and wake up finding out that they have a large coinsurance because a polyp was removed, which is the point of a colonoscopy, is to remove those polyps. It prevents the fact that we can't tell patients what colorectal cancer screening will cost sometimes, really prohibits the population-based types of colorectal cancer screening programs we'd like to do. And there, so it is, what is the possible justification? And then my third point is with data and working at the Iowa Cancer Registry. I would like to think that one of the major measures of success of the whole Moonshot Initiative will be a reduction in cancer mortality. That's measured by SEER cancer registries like the ones here in Iowa. So to me, again, it is, what is the possible justification that we have large payers, insurers all across the state, we have a dominant insurer. What is the possible justification that they don't have to report their cancer data to the Iowa Cancer Registry when providers do? I mean, there's a lot of electronic data sets sitting out there. It's not an interoperability issue. It's an issue of why can't we get all the data so we can measure things as accurately as possible.
It sounds like if the vice president walked into this room right now and said, Mary, I'd like you to make a list of 10 specific things that are barriers to you, that you would take about a minute to write down 10 things and then ask for 10 more that you could communicate to him. Let's move to Gail Bishop, Associate Director of Basic Science Research at the Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center. Gail Bishop, you've been in this field for a while, and now we're at a point, a turning point, I guess. How do you see the moonshot and how it affects what you do?
Well, I'm really pleased to see the increased emphasis and passion. So I've been doing research in cancer immunology, similar area to Laura, for over 25 years. And it's been wonderful to have the opportunity to see some of the very basic findings that were made in the laboratory back when I was a student and a fellow like Laura now come all the way to the kinds of therapies that Mo is using to treat his patients and, as I mentioned to you, put Jimmy Carter's cancer into remission. So as a cancer immunologist, it's never been a more exciting time to be doing research. And I also study in my lab cancers of cells of the immune system. I've been studying those molecular pathways for many years and are now seeing that those have utility in the sort of personalized precision medicine that the president has been talking about to pick the best treatments for patients. So I think in one sense it's a very exciting time, but the vice president also talked about barriers, and one thing that struck me quite viscerally, as I'm sure many of the other researchers in this room, is he said, we have to get researchers back in the laboratory and away from their computers writing grants. And you all know what that means. And I couldn't agree more. I mean, we all love to be at the bench and doing the work. And unfortunately, funding has stagnated over the past decade. And then with inflation, it's actually gone down. So another thing that struck me in the videos we saw and Vice President Biden's comments was he said, we have to decide. We have to decide what our priorities are. We have to decide and act on our decisions. And Representative Loebsack mentioned a new bill to try to increase funding for research, but it got through one house of a legislature and died in the other. And this is the story over and over again. So I think we have to decide what our priorities are, and then perhaps we need to be better at making noise about them and contacting our elected representatives and making clear that this is our passion and our priority. Mm-hmm. And
Jerry Quinn is with us, an RN, nurse manager at the Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center. Hi, Jerry.
Hi.
What were your thoughts as you watched the vice president and as you're listening to fellow panelists here? What strikes you?
So I would have to say that I think Vice President Joe Biden gave a clear picture of the role of the oncology nurse in the care of oncology patients. So adding to that, I've been an oncology nurse for many years. I've seen, as has also been described here, the increase in therapies, the increase in survivors. Where we're going from here, I think, is a very exciting time looking at accelerating research. Nurses are key to this in providing education to the patients about their therapies, providing the infusions, working with research and collecting the data and making sure that the data is put in accurately. So I think over that, nurses are very key to the success of the care of the cancer patient. So overall, in listening to everyone here, we are kind of the end of the rope, I don't want to say. We have the basic researchers doing a lot of research in the lab. There's drug development. And then on down the line, it comes to the nurses being able to provide either the IV infusions, providing education for the patients, giving the patients the resources, helping with symptom management, giving them the understandable data as to what's taking place with their care.
Okay, thank you. Jerry Quinn with the Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center. I have the pleasure of moderating a panel today, Iowa Cancer Moonshot Panel, started by Vice President Joe Biden in a live stream from Washington, D.C., followed up by a panel discussion with various participants here. And we are before an audience of 100, 150 or so here at the University of Iowa campus, College of Medicine, and I'd like to go to some of the questions that the audience members have passed down, and we'll just see. I'll ask you to sort of give me a signal, raise your hand if this is something you can address. One of our audience members asks, what advice does the panel have to improve patient interest in clinical trials? Who can speak to that? Okay, Mo.
I'm Mo. I'm a clinical trial investigator as well as a researcher. I think what I would do is inform the public what is a clinical trial. Everyone thinks it's that people are guinea pigs, and what you're really doing is you're spearheading the science. You're taking novel therapeutics and getting them approved faster through the system that's incredibly bulky and full of regulatory systems that stand in the way of new drugs being found for treatments that could be quickly spread across the cancer community. I'm going to echo a little bit on the immunology aspect. Rob participated in a clinical trial that was with a drug that was approved for the treatment of melanoma, and only because I'm a melanoma specialist, I moved it into sarcoma because I'm also a sarcoma specialist. It is one of the first treatments in immunotherapy in sarcoma that we're injecting directly this herpetic virus that has this very interesting biology of bringing white cells to the area as well as radiating the lesion and shrinking down the tumor. Rob didn't share that his tumor completely died with this therapy, and that we are hopeful that his body will remember the cancer and prevent it from coming back. Vice President Biden mentioned things about vaccines, which are really important. You know, his great-grandchildren's children could just get vaccinated at cancer, and Gail is working on vaccines in her lab that I would love to get closer to the patient. Barriers between us are getting closer, but they're still vast spaces. And I think informing the public that participation in trials is paramount for us to move our science forward is probably the way I would answer that question.
Let's go to Gary Streit, wants to jump in on that to answer as well.
I think another barrier has to do with the payer community, because I think in many instances, you know, off-label uses of drugs sometimes aren't reimbursed, sometimes treatment modalities are considered to be too experimental and not eligible for coverage. And so you have the very realistic conundrum that patients face of, gosh, I'd like to participate, but how can I pay for it?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask just speak on what Gary just said, too. My angels up there in the upright. I can see you wearing gray because they forced you to wear gray, which I don't understand. My angels up there are clinical care coordinators that are nurses that take care of patients on clinical trials. And when we want to put a patient on a clinical trial, there's a lot of background things that are done. Rob will tell you that it was seamless from his perspective because he didn't feel it. But there's a lot of effort and a lot of hoops and a lot of things that we have to jump through just to put a patient trial. One of the most important things is going to third-party payers and saying, would you please pay for this clinical trial?
Jenny is someone who has written on Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. She heard about the Iowa Cancer Moonshot and asks, what will be done to accelerate less toxic and more effective treatment for childhood cancers? Who wants to tackle that? Anyone on our panel? Okay. Okay. Gail is gonna try here on that one. Gail Bishop with the Cancer Center here.
I think that's a good question, and it's important. Not just for children, but for all cancer patients, people who have been cancer survivors or known cancer survivors, particularly of traditional chemotherapy, know that the side effects can be really difficult and can last for a long time, and this is a very active area of research. And here again, I think the more biological therapies that are being developed now are going to be a great way to address that because they aren't putting such wide spectrum toxic drugs. The early chemotherapy always had as its goal to kill cells that were rapidly proliferating, but we have lots of cells that are normal that are rapidly proliferating, like the cells that make our hair, which is why chemotherapy victims lose hair, and the cells that line our intestine. So we want to spare those, and the more precision medicine, the more biologically targeted, the immunotherapies, the pathway inhibitors, have great promise to target specifically the malignant cells while leaving the normal cells, sparing the normal cells. So I think these advances are coming, but we need to make them faster.
Another question from our audience. Prevention is important, but most of the focus seems to be on treatment. What can be done to include behavioral and public health scientists in Iowa's moonshot? Mary? Mary, with the Department of Epidemiology, we do know how to stop a lot of cancers, but we're not succeeding in so many ways, right?
Right. Again, I think it's getting people to change their behaviors, especially things like smoking and obesity, which are, you know, account for a lot, over half of our cancer deaths. To me, that's the cold fusion that we're trying to solve. Even with the treatments and some of the vaccines and some of the studies trying to figure out what causes cancer, I feel like in the end, the message is still going to be, we can do this for you, but you have to quit smoking. And we still have a lot of cancer survivors that have gone through it and then are still smoking afterwards. I think, as Dr. Squire mentioned, we know the most effective ways to do it. It's just a matter of that collaboration between legislators, policymakers, researchers, and getting people. Because there's the programs are out there. It's just, when we talk about prevention, we're talking about everybody. And so it's a low cost, but it's for a huge number of people, versus treatment, which is usually very high cost, but it's for a small number of people. And so I think it was sort of obvious from the Vice President's comments that his focus is a little bit more in the treatment area, which I do not dispute or contend with at all. But I do think we know how to prevent so many cancers. And if we could prevent those cancers, then we really could put all our resources into treating the ones that we haven't figured out yet and figuring out the thousands of different types of cancer that there are.
Dr. Milam, Mo?
I don't know if people actually know there's prevention trials for normal volunteers. For just the average person, you can participate in preventing treatment or participate in trials that actually try to address specifically prevention in specific types of cancers. There's been a lot of work, takes a long time to get those studies through, but that's a very powerful message that we can send back to the public too.
I wanted to throw this out to the panel in preparing for this program, I was reading in the New York Times, a critical voice here about the cancer moonshot in the United States, written by, I think, Jarl Breivik is how you say his name, a professor of medicine at the Institute of Basic Medical Sciences at the University of Oslo. If I can quote just a little bit and have whoever would like react to this. His reaction to the moonshot, the title of his opinion piece, "We Won't Cure Cancer." But cancer isn't space travel. The growing cancer epidemic is not a problem that medical science is about to solve. In fact, it is a problem we are about to make worse. The better we get at keeping people alive, the older they will get, and the more cancer there will be in the population. How we deal with this paradox will shape the future of society, and our leaders need to understand why. Mary, you would like to... What's your reaction to that comment?
Well, I agree with actually a large part of it in that, you know, there's been studies out there that show we could be exposed to zero environmental hazards. We have nothing, no exposures. And if we simply live long enough and our cells divide long enough, they'll make enough errors that will cause eventually cancer. But what I would say to that is I think targeting childhood cancer, targeting cancer in people who... are 38 years old and getting breast cancer. You know, people in the young population that should be a huge target. Not that the older population shouldn't be, but I do believe that that's a true statement, that if you live long enough, you'll eventually die of cancer. If you don't get heart disease, if you don't have a stroke, if you don't have anything else, and your cells replicate and they have long enough, you probably will die of cancer. But I think dying of cancer at 100 is very different than dying of cancer at age 14.
Mm-hmm. Even if we develop... Let's suppose that there are phenomenal increases in research. We make a quantum leap, as the vice president describes here. Is everybody in our society going to be able to afford these treatments? Isn't that really a question? Are we going to have a top tier of people who get really phenomenal treatments, and others who just can't afford it, perhaps the bulk of the population who can't afford it? What's the answer to that question? What do you see in the future? Gail.
I'm going to stick my neck out here and say I hope I live long enough to see the day that the people who run our country realize that the richest country in the world needs to provide health care for all of its citizens, and that we need to decide to do this. It's a moral imperative, I believe.
Can we afford as a nation, as a country?
Well, I think we need to make hard decisions, and we need to look at data, what interventions are most important, prevention, basic medical care. The vice president talked about some of these treatments. Why are they so expensive? Why do they increase fivefold over 5 years or 10 years? Why do we pay more for drugs than any other country in the world? That has to be part of the discussion as well.
Gary Streit wants to get in here as well, connected with the American Cancer Society.
And we have to look at the totality of the cost. For example, in Iowa alone, the cost of tobacco-related illness every year is over $1 billion. And yet we as a state fund a paltry $6 or $7 million we have to wear out the knees in our pants begging the legislature for a skeleton tobacco control program. So I don't think it's a lack of money. It's where we put the money and how we decide where to spend it.
Another question from our audience as we begin to wrap up this conversation. How do we improve collaboration in research among institutions and reduce competition for research funding support? As I understand it, in talking with some of you beforehand, the other comprehensive cancer centers in the United States involved in the moonshot, you're all competitors. You're competitors for grants, so you're not necessarily set up to unify and share and work on these goals, are you, or is that correct or incorrect?
So I think I can speak to something.
Laura.
As a postdoc, I am still a trainee and early days in my career, and perhaps I can offer a little bit of hope for the change that I'm seeing in science. You know, I am young enough in a cancer research lab that I never really did research without the internet. I am part of a very global generation. I don't think that collaboration is as strange of a thing to my age group as it might be to somebody who is late in their career. And also, I know in my limited experience as a researcher, the culture of collaboration is very much promoted. And so as we enter the era of big data, that is, labs generating data that they may not be able to analyze, you necessitate collaboration across different fields. And I think that's been very beneficial, and part of why we're seeing such a great impact in the clinic is the fact that we have bioinformatics and statisticians that are on board with us. That I know nothing about. I can do the technical bench work, but then applying it in the clinic, I need to know people who actually work in the clinic and see patients who are behind my idea. And here at Iowa, I think we do have a pretty decent job of, you know, having my voice, even as a trainee postdoc in a lab, my science being heard by clinicians and interest being generated. And I think that you know, will be a problem that it's certainly hard to overcome, but is being overcome.
Laura Rogers, a postdoctoral fellow in a cancer research laboratory at the Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center at the University of Iowa. Let's wrap up with this question, if I could, from our audience. What can Holden do, the Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center, do to focus on the whole patient to improve patient outcomes in addition to treating their disease? What's behind that question? Jerry, you've got your hand up there. Jump in there. Jerry, our RN and nurse manager at the center.
So I think that we are doing a fairly good job of looking at the whole patient, and we are expanding some of the resources that we have in the cancer center. So currently we have added a dietitian to seeing our patients in the cancer center, along with access to psychology and psychiatry. We've also involved physical therapy in seeing some of our patients as they can. Some of the driving forces behind this also is payer and insurance and whether they will pay for some of these. We have been able to overcome some of that by not charging the patient for the service. So in addition to that, we also have survivorship clinics that are looking at our patients that have survived cancers, are long term survivors, and looking at the side effects they may have from the treatments that they receive. This is both for pediatric patients that are now adults and adult patients that are survivors.
Okay, that wraps up our part of the program here. I want to thank the Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center and Dr. George Wiener for the invitation to Iowa Public Radio and to me to be a part of this event, the Iowa Cancer Moonshot Summit in Iowa City, June 29th. So many thanks to our panelists for giving us the varied perspectives we need to understand this big national push to accelerate progress in research and treatment of cancer. And thanks to our audience for being here. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you all.